Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio and transcript will be available on our website at cfr.org. We are delighted to have Daisy Khan with us to talk about community efforts to combat extremism and Islamophobia in the United States. Daisy Khan is the Executive Director of WISE, the Women's Islamic Initiative in Spirituality and Equality. Ms. Khan is a regular contributor to major media outlets, including CNN, Al Jazeera, BBC News, and has served as an advisor to a variety of documentaries. Born in Kashmir, Ms. Khan spent 25 years as an interior architect for various Fortune 500 companies. In 2005, she dedicated herself to full-time community service and building movements for positive change. In recognition of this work, she is a recipient of numerous awards, including the Interfaith Center of New York's James Parks Morton Interfaith Award, among others. She was also selected by Women's E! News as one of the 21 leaders for the 21st century. Daisy, thanks very much for being with us today to talk about your exciting project. It would be great if you would begin by giving us an overview of the Wise Up report and talk us through the impetus behind the creation.
Thank you very much, Irina, and thanks to CFR and to all the participants who have joined in. We're very excited to have you, and I think there's been quite a good response, which shows the eagerness and the importance of the issue that we're discussing today. Irina, the reason why we did this is because, recently we're seeing in the United States the overarching sort of change in consciousness and shift in attitude and shift in paradigm, which is all based on fear or, you know, fear of the other. It's almost eroding our core values or threatening to erode our core values, and it's done by a small, very dedicated group of people. It potentially could affect our social contract that we've had in the United States for you know, centuries now. And similarly, this kind of fascism, communism, racism, and secularism, in all these cases, there is a small group of people who always paint themselves as saviors of the people and always defending against a perceived external threat. And why I'm saying this as a backdrop is because, these groups tend to target always the other, the minority. You know, in the United States, many years ago was anti-Semitism, and recently we've heard attacks on Mexicans and especially on Muslims in every debate and in every rally. And the result of that is Islam and terrorism gets linked with ISIS, Muslims are perceived as a national security threat, which then gives rise to Islamophobia and rise to hate crimes, and having all kinds of unimaginable effects on a small, vulnerable community. And this fear narrative, we Muslims are very familiar with it because we have been witnessing it globally throughout the world, where this narrative, this fear narrative or the fear of the other, has also taken root and manifested into real groups who are politically motivated groups who want to do, who want to commit violence to meet political ends. And they, too, are a threat to the globe. They're a threat to the 1.6 billion Muslims because they're rewriting Islamic values and history and threatening the very core values of our religion. And in the United States recently, the public debate on terrorism, especially since 9/11 and violent extremism, has become inevitably a highly charged affair. Every time you talk about it, every time somebody's trying to build a mosque or trying to build a community center or somebody's running for office, the atmosphere gets very charged. And from our experience, we have seen that. So what we try to do is we try to create a task for ourselves of deepening our collective understanding of not only American Muslims on what they think about extremism, but how do they also think of themselves as Americans. And how can they, as a community, be at the forefront of creating a change or at least creating some sort of a coherent conversation and possibly solutions to extremism. That was a goal. And with that goal, we conducted a survey amongst American Muslims, and we asked them, what are your concerns? And, of course, the reputation damage to Islam in the media and how it impacts public perceptions of Muslims as a community was rated the highest. Secondly, when we asked them about what do we need to do to counter extremism, what methods should we, what should be the highest priority, at least, as a collective group, as Muslims, as government employees, as, think tanks, what should be the priority? And, we weren't surprised, but the respondents said that they desired more community engagement or community-led efforts, tailored specifically to that community as the highest, and second rated was diplomacy and followed by foreign policy, and not surprisingly, military engagement was the lowest. And there is, of course, some skepticism surrounding the effectiveness of current responses to extremism, which are not community-based, and that is why we were pleased that the Muslim community itself thought that community-based or community engagement or community-led initiatives were the answer. So that is, in a nutshell, why today Wise Up came into action and why Wise Up became what it is it's a community-led effort trying to address the issue of extremism holistically. And I say this holistically because past efforts have entirely focused on the kinetics approach, military engagement, intel, homeland security, and have entirely ignored the role of ideology. And when I say ideology, I mean that which is a motivating framework for how extremist groups operate. And so the ideology cannot be confronted or, spearheaded by anybody other than Muslims, because it is our religion. These are our core values, and we're the only ones equipped and have the credibility in the community to spearhead that. So that is why we focused our efforts in Wise Up to really go inside ISIS and to actually see what are they doing, how are they operating, how are they distorting our religion, which, is practiced by 1.6 billion people, and how have they been so effective? Why are they so effective when they are clearly distorting our scriptures? So we have, in Wise Up, created various sections, which I will speak about after I close my first opening statement.
Great. And I think this would be a good point to talk about how you've the strategic plan for Wise Up and how you've divided those chapters.
Yeah. So first, continuing with the survey, we asked American Muslims what was the how did they feel the portrayal of American Muslims vis-a-vis media? And 90% of respondents indicated that the portrayal of Daesh in the mainstream media, Daesh meaning ISIS, in the mainstream media had a negative impact on popular perceptions of Muslims. And it's no wonder that Americans think that somehow Islam itself is linked to terrorism. And vast majority of people did not understand or do not really know that 80% of terrorist attack victims are in fact Muslims, and there has been an increase, 80% increase in the number of fatalities because of terrorism, and almost entirely in Muslim majority countries. So these are facts that we decided to create a section where we would first give a backdrop of what ISIS is, how it's a politically motivated group which is willing to use violence. Then how did they actually come about, the kind of the historical reference points, going back to World War II and the interference of Western powers and propping up, authoritarian regimes, creating a sort of a political climate for how these groups have eventually risen up. Then we fleshed out exactly how do they take ideology, how do they actually take religion and frame it as ideology, and why do they need religion and ideology? You know, we found that religion is the one thing that was common to all Muslims of all socioeconomic backgrounds, as well as nationalities and ethnicities, because really, other than our religion, nothing else binds us together, you know. And so using religion as a veneer, as a rallying cry, it was a great mobilizer. And, of course, those people who are on this call who are religious people know that other religions have also been manipulated in past times and even recently. So we organized book one to compare Daesh's ideology to Islamic theology. We went into ISIS's website. We dug very deep into everything that they say, and we unearthed about 8 core concepts of Islam that they distort. And we then began comparing them side by side, and I had sent a PowerPoint presentation in which we described briefly how they distort these terms. And, you know, they take a very common term, which means al-wala wal-bara, translated as loyalty and disavowal, which is the foundation of their ideology, meaning you give your loyalty to them and nobody else, and you disavow everybody else who is not like them, which is a false interpretation of that. And we show that side by side of what is their distortion and what is the true Islam. And then they distort terms like ummah, which is readily been, Muslims call themselves the nation of believers, in which in past times when the Prophet was, you know, writing his covenant for his community, he included religious minorities, Jews, Christians, and even pagans in that. He said, everybody is under my protection. So that's Islam, and yet Daesh's version is, we are the only rightly guided people, and we're the only ones you have to follow because everybody else has gone astray. So now that we have all gone astray, we can be excommunicated and we can be declared as apostates. And this is no wonder then why people like Daesh have no difficulty killing Muslims on the streets everywhere, fellow Muslims, because then they have declared everybody an apostate. And so all of these terms, whether it's ummah, takfir, bayah, meaning give your pledge and allegiance to the ultimate caliph, who is like the only rightly guided human being right now in their eyes, then if you do that, you have to give your allegiance to that person, then you have to be prepared to fight for them. And they have redefined jihad to mean killing people, which, of course, is not the definition of jihad at all. And they have redefined hijra, which means making a migration. In case you are being persecuted, you have the right to leave that place. They rebrand that as you have to leave the comfort of your home, your families, your jobs, and everything, and join us because an obligation on you. So then martyrdom, of course, is a big one, and they have redefined martyrdom to mean that in order for you to be a true martyr, you have to be prepared to kill yourself, which, of course, every Muslim that is on this call will tell you that suicide is forbidden unless you are, you know, mentally your mental faculties aren't there. And then they have declared a state, and they are neither Islamic nor are they a state. And we all know that the things that they do in that state are a complete distortion of our scripture. So they've taken these terms because oftentimes, you know, the people that they're speaking to are not learned, don't have enough, religious knowledge, and it's very easy to fool people. It's why so many converts fall into the trap of being easily recruited by Daesh, because they can fool you with all these wonderful, wonderful terms. So we painstakingly, for the purposes of the general public, showed you in black and white, side by side, these terms, and then we had scholars who we invited to write a lengthier piece so that you could really, we could flesh out every concept. This is our book of theology, and this is our answer, and this is what we hope that communities will be able to use whether in the community centers, Christian leaders can use it, because then they can understand the differences. And this is our effort to once and for all de-link the religion of Islam from the terrorists, because the link between the two gives them credibility. And once they have credibility, they walk under the banner of Islam, and they legitimize themselves. So de-linking that is very key. Then book two, we spent a fair amount of time on book two, which is on their recruitment tactics, and we wanted to see how they actually recruit people. And in this process, we had a wonderful contributor who came on board, Steve Hassan, and he actually told us that looking at our recruitment steps, that actually Daesh's recruiting is very similar to cult recruitment, and ultimately their goal is to strip your old identity to the identity of the group. And it's very clear to us when we go through the recruitment process how they do it and how much emotional appeal they use and how equipped they are with psychological tools to really convince you that what you are doing, in fact, is the right decision for you. So they actually have 16 steps to their recruitment, and in every step, in the third or the fourth step, they start introducing religious terms, and then they start blasting you with their version. And that is why, you know, people get very easily fooled and fall into their trap. Then we felt that it was really important that we also have a tool for parents, and so that parents who are struggling with this issue should know how to at least intervene at the early stages, because every time there has been an attack in the United States, very recently, the Chelsea attack, prior to that, you know, the Chattanooga attack, prior to that, the Orlando attack, there have always been parents struggling with this issue, not knowing what to do and who to turn. And in some cases, they've actually turned to the FBI and have not gotten any help, because the person has not committed a crime, and unless they've committed a crime, and then, of course, the FBI has been watching them, and the result is that either they kill a lot of people or they get killed themselves. This is a great tragedy. We want to prevent this tragedy. We want to provide this toolkit in the hands of families, community leaders, so that they can be empowered with the knowledge on what to do, what steps to take, how to speak to your child. So we invited a wonderful parenting specialist who gave us some wonderful, wonderful insight on how to parent children so they listen in this environment, in an environment where there are many influences, outer influences on the child, and to move away from transactional parenting, which some immigrant parents tend to do, to move away from that to more transformational parenting. And there are steps in there in case your child is being recruited, how you can create community resilience and bring families together in communities and not shun a family and not shame a family because somebody has fallen in the wrong path. Then we also felt that it was really important for parents and youth to look up to role models, because in Daesh's push and pull factors, one of the factors of why people join them is this desire to either become a hero, because they tell you that if you join us, you will be doing heroic acts. So the absence of a heroic image is, you know, they're filling the void. So we created a wonderful, the end of the book with the inspiring through role models. Some ancient heroes who actually fought in revolutionary wars, but fought them with the rules of engagement that one has to fight, but also current day ordinary people who have given their lives to save other people's lives. We wanted these to be you know, to inspire people and inspire younger people. That was our book two. And then, you know, many Americans always ask us, where are the Muslims and why don't they speak out? This is a question I've heard repeatedly. And I decided that we should take the time since this Rise Up is coming out and it's going to get a fair amount of attention when we launch it, that we might as well take this opportunity to actually show all the condemnations that we know of. So we've collected some 200 condemnations from since 9/11 and listed them. These are major fatwas issued by scholars, academics, organizations, and put them in one place so the American public can see this. So the
let me just interrupt you there and just for a minute. Are those condemnations, are they covered by the press?
So many of these condemnations are hardly ever covered by the press, and it's one of the reasons why everybody thinks the Muslims are silent and don't speak out. And some of these condemnations go all the way back to like 7 days after 9/11, when a major, major fatwa was issued by seven scholars saying that 9/11 was a terrorist attack, and American Muslims who were serving in the army had every right to go defend their nation. This was a very big fatwa. It barely got any mention, and it was tragic because had it got attention, the right attention, the American public would have seen that Muslims had spoken, and of course that's why we are revealing these condemnations now, because we want the American public to see it with their own eyes, and
right.
It's already working because I have shown it to people where people have said to me, where are the Muslims and why don't they speak out? And I tell them, here are all the condemnations. Every link is here. You can go into this. Then it was really important, after consulting with a lot of Muslim organizations in New York that we consulted with, and the 60 contributors who have now contributed to this project, you know, wonderful, wonderful scholars, imams, everybody so eagerly wanting to be part of this, least deterred by any fear. I was really, really touched by the responses that I got from everybody, and how quickly people were eager to submit their articles at no cost. So we all decided that it was also important for American Muslims to tell their own story, because our story is being written by others. And others are writing our history, and it's a caricature of who we are. It's not who we are. So we had book three, which is entirely devoted to American Muslims, and it's divided into two sections. The first section is how we are a challenged community, and by challenges we have everything from how Islamophobia impacts us, and how it actually affects domestic security, you know, the impact of erosion of civil liberties on Muslims and what it actually does and how is it perceived, and the actual impact on Muslims. And the Islamophobia in America, and how it is really just a new incarnation of the old intolerance that has been experienced by other faith communities, particularly Jewish and Catholic communities. We are seeing that played out. This article was submitted by ISPU, played out in Sharia legislation, where there are these sort of call for banning Sharia as a foreign law, and how that is manifesting in mosques being closed, and then how does it feel to be a problem, to always be perceived as a problem? There's an article written by Mustafa Bayoumi, who's a professor. And he talks about what it's like to be seen as a problem, how Hollywood covers Islam, and how Hollywood is generally liberal, but when it comes to Islam, they have not seen the need to really portray Muslims in their everyday life or in their true nature, rather than, you know, just always showing them as terrorists or burying really good stories about Muslims. We hope that after they read this article, that perhaps maybe they will have a change of heart Then we also have an article about how defamation of Islam is actually at the root of what the bigots want you to believe, that they want to convince Americans that Islam itself is a flawed religion, and the tactics that they use to convince people that our religion is flawed. Then we have the second section, which is the American Muslims as a community that is deeply vested in America from the earliest of times. We have a wonderful article, First Amendment and Religious Freedom, by Imam Talib Sharif of the Nation's Mosque in D.C., and he reminds us that Thomas Jefferson actually declared Islam as an official American religion. Then we have an article on how Islam is actually an American religion and how it's taking root as an American religion, and similar to, the Catholics and the Jews before us. The Importance of Public Service by Constance Keith Ellison, of how, people have to get involved in public service, but also how there is so much civic engagement in the community that is that hardly gets any notice. The story of refugees, a reminder to Americans that we have embraced refugees in very large numbers from Muslim countries, from Bosnia, and how that refugee community is flourishing in the United States and doing so well, and how they are good citizens but also model Muslims. We have an article by a young person who writes about the struggle of identity, of what it's like to be confronted for both sides, from wanting to be self-critical, but also, always being told by Americans that you're not a good enough citizen. And we have an article that talks about embracing Islam in an age of extremism, the journey of a person who has become a Muslim recently, a Latina, and how difficult it is to be on that path, on that journey, because you are confronted by these very difficult questions about ISIS and terrorism. You have an article by a Jewish, a Muslim woman who has paired up with a Jewish woman, Salam Shalom organization. They have decided that it's better to hope, not to hate, and to work together collaboratively to bring peace to our communities. We took the time to show Americans how Muslims have actually contributed to America. And our contributions in science, in media, in sports, in all the different fields, engineering, law enforcement, all the fields. I think we have about 30 celebrity Muslims in music, in comedy, theater, everything. And then, of course, we talk about the evolution of an American mosque, of how the very first mosque was established from the earliest times in Georgia, during the slave trade. So we want to show Americans that Muslims have been here from the very beginning, that we're not new arrivals. Yes, there are immigrants who come on an ongoing basis, and they are here. But, a large chunk, I would say 40% to 45% of the Muslim community is African-American and very much part of the American fabric, so we should not be othered as if we have just arrived recently. So,
if you could just maybe wrap up. We have a lot of people on the call, and I know that you're really interested in getting people's input and involving them in the conversation. So maybe we could say a couple last words, and we can open up. So we have half an hour for questions.
Yeah, actually, I was going to wrap up. So that was the three books that we have. These are the three sections of one book. The book is currently being called Wise Up. We want to take this on the road. We would like to launch at the after the inauguration, sometime in January, February. Shortly after that, we'll be doing a congressional briefing. So we will be meeting all the members of Congress, handing a book to them. We want to be at the forefront, but we can't do this alone. We need all our partners, people of different faith, people of conscience, to step forward, work with us, because we can't do this alone. This is not our problem. This is a collective problem. We are all responsible for it in some way or the other, and there's enough evidence in our book of how different people have contributed to this problem. But we're willing to take the lead. And So shortly after the congressional briefing, we would like to launch a 50-city tour around the country. And whoever's on the call, if you are in different states, we'd love to organize a forum, bring this conversation so that our national conversation about Islam and Muslims and about terrorism and about this threat and fear, we can have a more coherent conversation. So I will close with that. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing this exciting, your exciting report and project with us. I think it will be an invaluable contribution to the public sphere. So let's open it up now to questions from the group.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. And we are currently holding for questions. Our first question comes from Daniel Pinkus with AJC.
Hello. Thank you, Daisy, for the presentation. I had a quick question regarding warning signs, or what are the, if we did a root cause analysis on what are the, are there common elements that, that draws people to extremism? Are there generational issues? Are there, are people motivated by religious or political movements? Is there a regional dynamic going on? Is it related to people who have a longstanding relationship to the community, or are they, so to speak, new converts to it? Are there trends, or is there a general picture that, that we can help identify maybe trouble issues? Are there warning signs that would help us identify regions that might or communities that need more attention than others?
So that's a good question. So there is no profile of a person anymore, because you will see that people who join come from very different socioeconomic backgrounds. They can be converts, they can be white people, they can be, Muslims who come from immigrant backgrounds, they can even be African Americans who may have embraced Islam, they can be people, former prisoners, criminals, all kinds of people. But what we have found from our research is that the push and the pull factors are many. So there is no one factor why people join, but different regions have a slightly different one. So one is for somebody who just desires to be a better Muslim, which might be a calling, and they just fall into the trap of an ISIS website when they start engaging with these people and they get trapped. And because ISIS offers the true version, or they tell them that, that we have the true Islam. Bleak future outlook, majority of Muslim nations that are struggling with jobs, that is a common one for those people in that region, because ISIS offers a lucrative future in state building. They say, if you come here, you'll have a job. So for that for some, that's a motivation. I mentioned, for example, of glory. That is for those people who are looking for meaning in life, and have not found that, and so they join for that reason. Sympathy and suffering for Muslims and injustices against Muslims worldwide is a big one, and that pretty much crosses everywhere, because during their recruitment process, they really bombard you with all kinds of images of Muslims who are being killed and with drone attacks. And so they bombard you with that stuff. So that's a factor for almost every place you go. There's a call for justice, and so that's a strong one. Social marginalization, isolation, alienation is addressed primarily to Western Muslims, and that's something that we in America can avoid. The rise of Islamophobia, bullying, the kind of rhetoric that we've been hearing in recent debates from one of our candidates, that stuff that becomes instant recruitment propaganda for ISIS. And so social marginalization. Disconnect with Western culture is another one, where people don't feel that they fit in, or they feel that somehow that modern Western culture is at odds with their faith, And once again, that's lack of knowledge or lack of information. And so they join because they are offered a very pristine environment where, you know, Islam is being practiced in its pure form. That's the offer on the other side. And fascination of curiosity of ISIS just makes you fall into a trap of befriending a whole bunch of new friends. And that can happen to anybody who gets who's lonely and sitting at home on a computer and just is looking for friendship. So that's also another way to have a whole new set of friends. So there is no one thing, but all of these factors exist, and for some regions they're more and for some others less.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from John Davies from Canadian Multi-Faith Federation.
Thank you for the story, and to help tell the story, where can I access the Rise Up books? Would they be at local mosques, or can you address that, where to get the book?
So the book will be published, and if you send us an email, we'll put you on an email list, and we will notify you when the book will be available, but we would like to publish it and have it available on Amazon, so hopefully, you know, we should have the book at the time of the launch, but if we don't, we'll notify you when the book comes out. But there will be a website for Wise Up, which we will be constructing soon. It's not available yet, but the website itself will have enough information, but maybe not the entire toolkit.
Thank you.
Daisy, we can also circulate the email address that you would like people to use.
Mm-hmm.
Would you prefer that, or do you want to just give it out now?
Sure. It's daisy@wisemuslimwomen.org.
Great. And we can also follow up with folks.
Mm-hmm.
Just a reminder.
Next question.
Just a reminder, everyone, if you would like to ask a question, you can hit *1 on your phone now. Our next question comes from Philip Eubanks with Catholic Welfare Association.
Hi. So my question is really about the sort of culture of, the way in which facts don't really seem to matter, or they take a backseat to emotion. I'm curious, how do you combat Islamophobia in this toxic era where facts do take that backseat to emotion? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and you know, that is why we are told the story. So it's not so much fact-based, but really these are narratives. And we hope that these narratives will actually become podcasts so that these stories can be told. And so our ideal goal is when we're out there on a tour that our participants, our contributors can join us and show the human face of what we're talking about. And to humanize the problem is key. So telling these stories is important. And also showing that Muslims are very engaged in the American fabric is also important. As you know, when Khizr Khan spoke at the DNC and he spoke from his heart, very few people knew that Muslims had been in the military or engaged or been former veterans. And we have Muslims who are veterans who have served in armies. Those people will be brought out, and we want those people to come out and tell their stories. So there are ways to engage the American public. I fundamentally believe the American public is generally fair. And if we tell our story and we show that we are combating extremism and trying to take our religion away from the terrorists, that they will be not only sympathetic to our cause, but they'll also come along. I've seen this in my recent speeches, so I'm hopeful.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Susan Gilbert with Gilbert Consulting.
Thank you, Daisy, for an excellent presentation. And putting a highlight on a gender perspective for a moment, we're seeing more stories about women moving toward extremism. And I'm wondering, to promote positive female role models, What is your suggestion to show more examples of Muslim women as businesswomen, judges, and leaders?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So in the case of Daesh has actually been heavily recruiting women because the caliphate is dependent on women, and they're tapping into the sentiment of women as being, you know, as luring them with the concept of motherhood. And so what we have done in this book is we've actually shown what is the lure for women. Why do they go? Why do they join? They want to be birthers of a new nation. They feel that this is a huge responsibility being, given to them. And then we actually list the real heroes of Islam or heroines of Islam, starting with the Prophet's wife, who was a businesswoman and is a model for many women who are entrepreneurs, businesswomen, professionals, and show her life and what she endured and the difficulties that she had with the famine and how much hardship there was when she was supporting his prophecy, and then his daughter's life and other role models in Islam. And so we hope that these women become exemplars for women who are contemporary women who want to, imbibe them and follow in their footsteps. At WISE, we actually collected many of these women and we profiled them on our website. We have 500 women that are profiled on our website, and to show and to disprove that, you know, Muslim women cannot be engaged in society, cannot be engaged in professions. So we want to show that Islam inherently allows you to pursue your talent if you choose to.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from St. Paul Singh with State University of New York.
Hi, thanks for taking my question, and thanks for a great presentation. My question is linked to the question on root causes. Now, it's understandable that ISIS would craft a link to theology so that they can justify and promote their actions. In addition to that, is there any component of the following, that they do understand the link they are creating is not a real link, but they are just motivated by the lust and the glory and other highs of being in power and terrorizing other people and dragging them around? Is there any component of that?
I think you have a very valid point. But they will tell you from their point of view. They feel that their lives are stagnant. They have been part of nothing but revolutions, wars, mass migration, political and economic, transformations that they have not experienced. And they believe that foreign powers, were hand selecting individuals who actually brought this upon them. So that's their narrative. That's ultimately their narrative, is that we are trying to redress the wrongs that have been done to us, and that we have been pawns in this great chess game for a very long time, and we no longer want this, and we are prepared to fight for it, and so this is really just a fight. And there's no peace without justice, and of course justice is defined by them. I do think that they are, the fact that they can violate scripture, the fact that they can take every concept of Islam and distort it, leads me to believe, at least in our own research, that they see a power vacuum, and they want to fill it, and this is their chance to be in positions of power and to shape their destiny. And that ultimately is the most probably a very big factor of those people who are the masterminds of this. unfortunately, they bring a lot of innocent people with them and promise them other things, and they fall for it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from John Polakowinski with Catholic Theological Union.
Yes, thank you so much, Daisy, for a really an exciting project. My only concern would be, do you anticipate that major Muslim organizations here in the United States, like ISNA and CARE and so on, will give very public support to this effort? I don't wish in any way to demean the significance of the Muslim women's group, but my concern is, as I often hear this from people, well, there are some fringe Muslims who are, you know, doing the kind of thing that you're promoting, but that they don't represent the majority. So I think in terms of visibility, it would be quite important to have positive public support from some of the major Muslim organizations.
Thank you for asking that question, and maybe I didn't make that clear in the very beginning. We sought the counsel of many Muslim organizations, including ISNA, and we went around and spoke to people, and we invited people to be part of this project. So that's why we have 60 contributors, and we do have major Muslim organizations involved. We have Islamic Network Group. We have Adam Center, where Imam Majid is the imam. He used to be former president of ISNA. We have the Nation's Mosque. We have Muslim Public Affairs Council. Then we have individuals like Congressman Keith Ellison, and we have individuals that are highly regarded in the community who are imams in their own respective communities. So I think that we have called together a very good broad spectrum of the Muslim community, and they are so far, everybody that we've spoken to are looking forward to rolling this out in their own capacities, in their own communities. Because it is a community-led effort. So I do not expect any issues from ISNA. We've spoken to them. We are in conversations with them to see how they might be able to assist with the rollout.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Eleanor Ellsworth with Episcopal Diocese of San Diego.
Thank you. My question actually is very similar to the one you just addressed, but it was more specifically whether or not there are any Muslim groups that are actively in opposition to your work, or if there are any groups that are and not only just not supporting, but who may be for some reason on another side. If you could just elaborate a little bit more about that, I think it would be helpful. Thank you.
So I think that I will answer this question in a delicate way, because many people think that the Muslim community is kind of a monolith community.
No.
And it's not. And it's as diverse as, really, it's even more diverse than any other community, because we have not only different schools of thought, different approaches, we have all the ethnicities, all the nationalities, and we have imams from, you know, like, we have an imam who's the imam of the Albanian community, and he is considered to be their leader. So every mosque, because we are a very democratic religion, we don't have a central authority, every mosque has its own leader, every community has its own leader. So the question is, how can you bring together a good sampling of these people, including in that group of people who fundamentally have issues with the Muslim community really working in conjunction with law enforcement on this issue. So that was a very big issue, and this is why we, from the very beginning, said this was going to be a community-led effort with no government hand in it, and the 60 contributors that we have are really contributors that are, you know, contributing to this. So there is no agenda, there are no alternative, you know, aims. It's really, the aim is to empower the community and to provide information to the general public. So so we have so far succeeded in in rolling this out as a community effort. And down the road, if we have to do projects in different states and in different locales, we will be tapping into, once again, community groups to do specific trainings and to do rollouts. So that's our aim and our goal, because the 60 contributors span the United States, and each one of them has its own sphere of influence, as well as its own, people that we can tap into. So we'd like it to be as grassroots as possible, so that it's really, you know, being carried out in their own respective communities with their own solutions.
Thank you. Congratulations on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Manaz Efradi from Manhattan College.
Sonico and Daisy, this is Manaz.
Oh, hello, Manaz. Manaz is one of our contributors.
First of all, I want to say how exciting this project is. But, you know, for me, as someone who directs a center and has to fundraise and, you know, come up with all kinds of paradigms, I'm wondering, Daisy, how we can help you promote this project. And I'm also wondering how we are going to be able to launch a book, sell it, and fundraise for it.
Yeah. As you know, that's always an issue for every nonprofit. So we would like to publish the book, and the book publishing has changed a lot in recent times, and many of them want to secure certain books being purchased ahead of time. So that is what we will be asking people to do to help us, you know, pre-purchase the book so that we can get the book published well ahead of time. So that's one way that everybody can help and get your copies, maybe, you know, 5, 10, 20 copies. And then, of course, be prepared to become ambassadors for the project in surrogates. We can train anybody. We are actually looking to train, Christian leaders, Jewish leaders, open up your churches, open up your synagogues, open up the mosques, so we can come out and create real forums on at the ground level. If people would like to be trained by us on this issue, we'll be happy to bring the training either through webinar or directly at the local level so that more and more people can be talking about this issue properly. So you can be deployed, you know, in any state you want to be deployed within the time constraints that you have. That is how you can help us.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Judy and Steve Gillian, from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Public Affairs. Excuse me, Mr. and Mrs. Gillian, your line is live.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
Yes. Can you
Go
hear
ahead.
Me now?
Yes,
yes.
We can.
Hello?
Now we can't. Did you mute your line?
I think she muted it and then unmuted it.
Let's maybe move on to the next question,
okay.
And hopefully she'll keep.
Oh, she's back. Can you hear me now?
Yes,
yes.
We can hear you, Jillian.
Okay, I am so sorry.
No problem.
I was just wondering if you will be speaking in the Southern California area anytime soon.
Well, we want to roll out in every state, so if you invite us, we'll be there.
Oh, good. And another resource in Southern California that would give you a group of mosques in one sitting is the Shura Council of Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And they have membership of over 80 mosques,
mm-hmm,
who participate as a body. And I could send you contact information for that if you would like. We have wonderful professional Muslim women here, and we have organizations like New Ground, which is a Muslim-Jewish partnership of women,
mm,
and we even have a women's mosque that...
Yes, I know that.
So I feel like your program would blossom here.
Yeah.
Even though I'm a friend of Muslims, being a Mormon myself, but we certainly respect and loved Mormon people, the Muslim people, and work hand in hand with them here. And we know many here in the area, and would certainly support your program being here.
Thank you. So if you can just send me an email, we'll be happy to stay in touch with you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Great.
Bye.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Asim Farooqi with Islamic Center of Rockland, New York.
Assalamu alaikum, Daisy. My name is Azim Farooqi. I am currently in Rockland County. Rockland County is one of the 62 counties of New York State, and there are four mosques. And I am a trustee of the Islamic Center of Rockland, located in Valley Cottage, New York. And I just want to inform you, yes, we have a very strong group of people, which is known as Rockland County for Social Justice, and including hundreds of Jewish and Christian clergy members. And they are very interested in holding a general meeting about the Islamophobia in the next few weeks. In fact, I am also asked by the Rockland Family Shelter to speak on this next month. So what you said earlier is quite germane to all the talk that we are having in the county about how to increase knowledge of Islam among the non-Muslim communities and doing so. We would love to collaborate with you. Anytime you want to have any help from us, please let us know.
That would be fantastic. We'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to get in one or two more people if possible. So if you have a couple of minutes to go over, that would be great.
Sure. That's fine. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Soraya Dean, the Muslim Women Speak.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Daisy, for this much-needed initiative. They say evil prevails when good people do nothing. I was curious to know what plans you had to promote the book overseas, where it might also be greatly needed.
Ah, yes. So our plan first is to launch in the United States, and I have been to several conferences on this issue, and wherever I go, people are thrilled and excited that such a product actually exists. What would be needed for next year as we begin the rollout in the United States, we would like to immediately roll it out in European countries where it's desperately needed. And for that, we would need to do translations in at least four or five languages, including obviously Arabic, because some people who relocate are still speaking the native language. That's the next plan. Is once it gets kicked off in the United States, we would kick off all over the world and through partners. We have a lot of women partners. As you know, WISE has a lot of women NGOs on the ground. We also know a lot of Muslim leaders in their own communities, young leaders, also, imams in other countries. So the goal is to roll this out. Other than the American Islam section, which is catered primarily to American Muslims, the two books, 1 and 2, which is on recruitment and on theology versus extremist ideology, can be translated as is. It does not require any changes because the product is relevant to all societies. We had advisor to of Azhar, advisor to the Grand Mufti of Azhar, who wrote the opening article for us, and he reviewed all the material, and he said this is completely relevant to Muslim societies. There's no need to change anything because it's very mainstream, interpretation of what Muslims believe. So we think that the books are ready to go. It's just a matter of translating them and then putting them into the hands of people and training people on the ground. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, Daisy, thank you very much for sharing your this project with us today. It was terrific to hear all the amazing work that you're doing, to what you've done to put it together. We look forward to seeing it come out. I know people, please do email Daisy so that she can alert you to when it will be available. And again, if you want to be involved, please let her know. And you can follow Daisy Kahn on Twitter at Daisy Kahn, and her organization WISE at WISE_leaders. So you can probably get information there. We also did circulate the PowerPoint presentation in advance of this call, which I encourage you all to go back and take a look at. So, Daisy, thank you very much.
Irina, I just wanted to say thank you very much for pulling this together for us. And I also want to thank all the participants and want you to know that even though this is being launched in probably end of January, February, you are the first to know about it. This is the first time we've officially done this pre-launch because we want people like you to be actively involved with us. So to the extent that you can contact us and be involved in any capacity, and that could mean literally opening the door to your congregation so we can come there and we can talk to people, that is what is going to give this legs, and that's what's going to change the conversation at the grassroots level. And I thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, and I encourage you all to follow CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements about upcoming events and information about the latest CFR resources. So we look forward to continuing the conversation on this important topic as well as many others. So thank you all.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.